Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg isn't backing down from his fight with the Federal Department of Justice. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Reporter Edward O'Brien has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about a growing divide in the Montana Republican Party. And Flathead reporter Catherine Fry takes us to the Whitefish homecoming for an injured Olympian. Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg met with the County Commission today to discuss the most recent revelations concerning his ongoing dispute with the United States Department of Justice. The Department of Justice investigated how the University of Montana, City Police, and Van Valkenburg's office handle reports of sexual assault that came to light in 2012. Investigators wanted to know if gender discrimination affected the response of local law enforcement and university officials to several reports of assault over an 18-month period. UM and the Missoula Police Department reached settlement agreements with the agency, but Van Valkenburg insists DOJ has no authority over the county attorney's office. All three Missoula County commissioners supported Van Valkenburg's stance, as well as his legal moves to have a federal judge issue a declaratory judgment in his favor. As Edward O'Brien reports, his defiance towards the DOJ hasn't wavered a bit, even if the support of one county commissioner has.
Fresh off his recent vacation, Fred Van Valkenburg noted it's always good to get back to Missoula, even if circumstances have changed a bit while he was away. And change they have. County Commission Chair Gene Curtis opened the meeting with a statement, and here's an excerpt.
My concern is that this community has lost faith in your office because of partly because of your posture and partly because of the DOJ report. So I would encourage you to take time to review all those allegations and work with the AG's office to look for ways to improve it.
Shortly after embarking on his vacation earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a press release describing what it said was substantial evidence the county attorney's office response to sexual assault discriminates against women. Van Valkenburg denied that and maintains his office is under the jurisdiction of the Montana Attorney General, not the DOJ. A 2012 agreement was recently revealed between then Attorney General Steve Bullock and the DOJ. That agreement essentially would have laid out referrals of new evidence of alleged sexual assaults from justice back to the state AG's office. As Montana Public Radio reported yesterday, Missoula County Commissioner Michelle Landquist views that communication as essentially a tacit cooperative agreement between DOJ, the Montana AG, and therefore the Missoula County Attorney. She was not aware of these letters when voting to support the county's lawsuit against the DOJ and as a result felt thrown under the bus. Van Valkenburg says the AG's office notified him about these letters in June of 2012. He describes them as of very little consequence.
And it's only because you say certain things about your interpretation of them that I guess I'm concerned now, because I don't think your interpretation is what actually occurred between the DOJ and the AG. And I certainly don't think, Michelle, and I would never do this, I don't think that I misled you or that I tried to mislead you or that you didn't get all of the information that was relevant to any decision about making a decision to appropriate money to pursue the declaratory judgment action.
Van Valkenburg maintains the letters say nothing about the authority to conduct any investigation.
The Attorney General simply agreed, as is kind of a common practice, that if somebody refers something to them for an investigation because they think maybe the county attorney might have a conflict of interest or something like that, that then they will look at it and see independently whether charges should be filed or a case should be reopened.
And he pointed out today that DOJ still, to this date, hasn't referred a single case for review to now Montana Attorney General Tim Fox. Landquist wasn't entirely convinced, as illustrated in this exchange. The first voice you'll hear is hers. The other female voice, off mic, is, again, that of County Commission Chair Gene Curtis.
What I'm saying is, without having previous knowledge of these letters, I would have made very different decisions on this. I would have asked you to cooperate, knowing that we would hold the DOJ accountable to follow these protocols.
But now
the DOJ hasn't even responded.
Now Attorney General Fox is holding them to those protocols, and that's great.
But But they haven't responded.
But
they
you
haven't yet responded. I realize this.
We had nothing to do with those protocols. They did not involve us one bit. They were protocols.
They were
protocols
for.
Between the DOJ and the AG. They didn't involve the Missoula County Attorney's Office.
Van Valkenburg painted the Department of Justice's February 14th letter of findings as filled with half-truths and outright lies.
Who supposedly said that boys will be boys? Who said Bible verses were quoted? You know, I don't think those things even happened. If they did happen, they had some context to them. And you can't tell what that is without knowing who said them, when they were said, and the context in which they were said. And the DOJ, they deliberately avoid putting that kind of information out. It's so unfair, it's unbelievable. And why anybody would believe it is beyond me, except that they're predisposed to believe it.
Commission Chair Gene Curtis today then pivoted the conversation to finding ways to better serve victims in Missoula County. Ideas included more inviting rooms for victim interviews, commission involvement on the First Step Advisory Board. First Step Resource Center coordinates a local children's advocacy center and an adult sexual assault response team. Van Valkenburg also would like to see crime victim advocates return to work directly in the county attorney's office. Those offices were separated years ago. He also mentioned more deputy county attorneys would be extremely helpful. But all these suggestions require deliberation, votes, and funding, which isn't readily available. The groups agreed today to wait for what, if any, direction comes from the Attorney General's office, which is itself waiting on the next move from the U.S. Department of Justice. And Van Valkenburg's lawsuit against the DOJ is still pending. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
And in other news from around the state, an autopsy found a 25-year-old man died of internal bleeding after being stomped on, and prosecutors have filed charges against a Hamilton couple. Ravalli County prosecutors are charging 25-year-old Richard Michael Sullivan with deliberate homicide in the death of Robert Thought of Hamilton. Candace Sullivan is charged with accountability for deliberate homicide or an alternative charge of conspiracy to commit deliberate homicide. They were scheduled to make an initial court appearance this afternoon. Court records say Candace Sullivan called 911 at 11:20 p.m. on January 28th, and responding officers found Thought was dead. An autopsy determined Thought suffered blunt force trauma to his abdomen up to 2 hours earlier and could have survived with prompt medical attention. Richard Sullivan reportedly told investigators that Thought sniffed his wife, prompting the fight.
The body of a homeless man has been found near the Civic Center in Butte. Butte-Silver Bow County Undersheriff George Skeletich says there were no signs of foul play and the cold weather may have been a factor in the 52-year-old man's death. His body was found at 5:15 yesterday afternoon. A toxicology report has been ordered. Officials have not released the man's name.
Police in Butte say a 32-year-old man bled to death after falling into glass from a broken window while he was too intoxicated to care for himself. Butte-Silver Bow County Sheriff Ed Lester tells the Montana Standard that Jeff Krause died Monday at a Butte residence. Lester says Krause was highly intoxicated and most likely tripped, causing him to fall into the broken glass and severely cut his left wrist. The sheriff says medical crews were called at about 7:30 p.m. Monday, an estimated 4 or 5 hours after Krause was hurt. Lester says if Krause had received immediate medical attention, the injury wouldn't have been fatal.
A federal jury has convicted a 31-year-old man of stabbing 3 women at a Poplar residence in March of last year. The U.S. Attorney's Office says jurors found Robert Louis Bershia guilty of 3 counts of assault with a dangerous weapon and 1 count of assault resulting in serious bodily injury. Sentencing is set for June 5th. Prosecutors alleged Bershia arrived at a residence in Poplar on March 6, 2013, and began drinking alcohol with 3 women. Court records say Bershia claimed a bottle of whiskey was his and then stabbed 1 woman, causing damage to her stomach that had to be surgically repaired. He then stabbed another woman who tried to protect the first victim. Prosecutors say Bershia then went back to a bedroom where a 3rd woman was sleeping and stabbed her.
A methamphetamine lab is suspected as the cause of a small explosion in a room at a Bozeman hotel. Bozeman Police Captain Steve Crawford says officers received a report of a possible explosion and fire at the Continental Motor Inn at 8:50 p.m. last night. Crawford says the small explosion blew out the window and slightly damaged the door of a second-floor room. He says there was no fire damage and no one was hurt. The Missouri River Drug Task Force is investigating. No arrests have been made as of this morning.
Attorneys for creditors from the 2008 bankruptcy of the exclusive Yellowstone Club want a federal judge to incarcerate the resort's founder for failing to heed court orders. The attorneys say developer Tim Blixeth has engaged in a pattern of deceit through years of litigation in which he's sought to limit his liability in the club's financial collapse. That includes his alleged defiance of a February 3rd court order to pay at least $13.8 million for selling a Mexico resort that was part of the bankruptcy proceedings. Blixeth, a resident of Washington State, said today he hoped to resolve the matter but did not offer specifics. The Yellowstone Club has been under new ownership since Blixeth left the private ski and golf resort near Big Sky as it spiraled into bankruptcy.
Montanans will be headed to the polls in a few months to vote in the 2014 primary election. It's a chance for voters to say what direction they think their party should be heading. That will be a big decision in many Republican primary races for the state legislature. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us a deep divide in the state GOP, which defined much of the 2013 legislative session, has yet to be bridged.
This split between moderate and conservative Republicans was most dramatically seen in the 2013 Montana Senate. Republicans held a 29-21 majority over Democrats, but it often seemed as if there were three caucuses, as a small group of Republicans openly defied party leadership to side with Democrats on some key issues, issues like school funding legislation, changes to campaign spending laws, and state employee pension reform.
It was hard to have one unified Republican voice because you had people splitting off from the party, becoming divisive, crossing over, and essentially acting like Democrats.
That's Senate Majority Leader Bozeman Republican Art Wittig. He's one of the leaders of the more conservative wing of state Republicans, which is recruiting far-right candidates to run against the 2013 moderates in this summer's primary. He says some of these moderates come from very Republican districts, so it's not really the general election where the winner is picked. The decision, he says, is in the primary.
Do people want to have that continued status quo government growth, or do they want some reform through conservative ideas?
Well, I would say that the split hasn't healed it at all.
That's Conrad Republican Representative Rob Cook.
I don't think there was any anticipation that it would before a series of primaries.
He's with that group of moderate lawmakers branding themselves responsible Republicans. He says the moderates did what they had to work with a Democrat in the governor's office. He says the conservative wing of Republicans has imported what he calls foreign angst into Montana politics.
Our budget situation is outstanding. Our school system is outstanding. And if you were to listen to them talk, you would think that we were at the bottom of the world. You know, they've kind of brought an apocalyptic fervor to Montana that isn't warranted.
What's happening with Republicans in Montana is reflective of what's happening nationwide, with Tea Party candidates taking uncompromising stances on many social and fiscal issues.
One big change in Montana is that we are starting to reflect national trends far more than we did a couple decades ago.
Carroll College political science professor Jeremy Johnson, and he says that's a big part of what's happening with the state Republican Party. There's something else, though, with the legislature. Johnson says splits like this can tend to happen with large majorities.
What unites a major political party the most is to have to fight against another majority from the other party.
He says the state would likely see more defined splits in the Democratic caucus if they took over control of the legislature. Some Republicans say they are actively working to bridge this divide in the state GOP.
The last couple of sessions, you've had strong egos leading the legislative session.
Stevensville Republican Senator Fred Thomas voted largely with the conservative wing in the last legislature. He says differences of opinion aren't new, but this rift is more pronounced, and he says everyone needs to take a step back and think about what's important. He suggests the disparate elements of the party focus less on the areas where they disagree.
Maybe we're not going to get the complete common ground on that. Well, let's set that aside. We don't need to bloody each other up and come back to it in another session, if that's the case. Whatever needs to be done. But let's not haul bills out on the floor and make each other look bad and throw a few rocks.
Perhaps it will be easier to take that advice after the primaries. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
A federal safety official says the rail tank cars being used to ship crude oil from North Dakota's Bakken region are, quote, an unacceptable public risk, and even cars voluntarily upgraded by the industry may not be sufficient. National Transportation Safety Board member Robert Sumwalt told a House subcommittee today that the cars, known as DOT 111s, were involved in derailments of oil trains in Castleton, North Dakota, and in Quebec, just across the U.S. border. The NTSB has long urged replacement of the tank cars, but federal efforts to write tougher regulations for new tank cars have dragged on for 2 years. Cynthia Quarterman, head of the Federal Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, said she expects to propose new rules this year. She had no estimate for when the rule would be final.
An organization representing 57 Northwest Indian tribes has announced its opposition to marijuana legislation, specifically in Alaska and Oregon. The Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians announced a partnership yesterday with the Smart Approach to Marijuana Project, which supports a treatment health-first marijuana policy. The tribal group says it supports efforts to reduce marijuana use, especially among young people. The group represents tribes in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Montana, Nevada, Alaska, and Northern California.
The head of Bonneville Power Administration has named two new officers in the wake of a hiring scandal at the power marketing agency. Administrator Elliot Mainzer announced today that Greg Delwish will serve as BPA's deputy administrator and Claudia Andrews will take on the role of chief operating officer. Mainzer's predecessor, Bill Drummond, resigned last month after the Energy Department placed him and chief operating officer Anita Decker on indefinite leave in July. The suspensions came after the department's inspector general investigated allegations of discrimination against veterans who applied for jobs at the agency and reports of managers retaliating against whistleblowers. The BPA markets power from 31 federal dams and manages much of the region's power grid.
Alaska Airlines and Horizon Air employees received an annual bonus today totaling $84 million. Seattle-based Alaska Air Group says the incentive pay amounts to about 9% of annual pay or 5 weeks' pay for most workers. More than $51 million goes to 6,400 Alaska and Horizon employees in the Puget Sound area. Another $11 million goes to about 2,000 employees in the Portland area, and $8 million goes to 1,700 employees in the state of Alaska. The rest goes to airline workers at other locations. The annual bonus is in addition to monthly bonuses last year that totaled to about $21 million. The combined $105 million is the highest in company history. Bonuses are paid for meeting goals for on-time arrivals, customer satisfaction, safety, cost controls, and profits.
An injury may have kept 15-year-old Maggie Voisin from competing in Sochi, but it did nothing to damper the enthusiasm of her hometown crowd. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry was there as Whitefish welcomed home its injured Olympian.
People of all ages line the street in Whitefish as Maggie Voisin and her family cruise through town on the top of a fire truck. Among the onlookers is 12-year-old Libby Goldhirsch.
Well, we wanted to see the parade for Maggie Voisin. She's our friend for a while, and we're just about to go cross-country skiing, so it's the perfect place for us to be right now.
Whitefish is a busy place, but still a small community. And Libby, as well as 12-year-old Sam Meinecke, Bridger Gertner, and Casey Schneider have some of the same school teachers Voisin had and have had the chance to see her ski when she was just starting to make a name for herself doing tricks at the Whitefish Mountain Resort.
We're really inspired by her. She's, like, pretty awesome with all the...
yeah.
With all the crazy jumping, going to Olympics
like the
thing?
Like 1080, cork, all that stuff. It's pretty cool. And she's from her hometown. We've never had anything like it before, so I think it's pretty awesome.
Just days after 15-year-old Voisin was asked to join the U.S. Olympic freestyle ski team, she took silver at the Winter X Games. A trick that particularly made everyone stand up and take notice was when she pulled off a switch 1080. For those of us not in the know, this involves a big ski jump, after which she spun three times in the air before landing. There's a video of her Winter X Games runs on our website. Voisin was part of a team competing in the first ever Olympic slopestyle event.
The energy was crazy. Everyone was just so excited. You know, there's definitely some nerves, but I think the games are really fun, and it's just fun to see all these people just come together and, you know, kind of be one.
During a practice run in Sochi, Voisin broke a bone above her right ankle, an injury that requires 4 to 6 weeks of healing. Before the parade in Whitefish, she stands in the sun, supported by crutches, her nails painted blue with stars and stripes, and a smile on her face. The injury kept her out of competition, but not far from the action.
Our event got done pretty early, so it was nice. Everyone else got done, and all my friends were done. And we were able to go, you know, down to the coast and watch hockey and, you know, just kind of experience everything. I got to, like, watch bobsledding and luge, stuff that I never would, you know, usually watch. It was just an incredible experience.
Voisin says she's out till spring or summer skiing. At 15, she's still in school. She says she's part of Team Academy, an online school, so she can get her work done around her training schedule. She says getting it all done, training, schoolwork, travel, is all about time management, and it doesn't fuss her much.
I get to do what I love, you know, for, I mean, I guess like a living, so it's fun to do something that you really enjoy, you know, and get to do it all the time.
For the next Winter Olympics, Voisin will have just had her 19th birthday. But in the years between then and now, we're likely to see her name a lot at the annual Dew Tour and the Winter X Games. Catherine Fry reporting from Whitefish.
Oregon's wolf population continues to grow and has spun off another wandering wolf that made it to the Cascades. A draft of the state's 2013 wolf report says tracks were confirmed last December on the eastern flanks of Mount Hood, about 200 miles west of the wolf packs in northeastern Oregon. 300 miles south in the southern Cascades, Oregon's famous wandering wolf, OR7, has been shuttling between Oregon and California looking for a mate since fall 2011. The report adds that one of Oregon's original breeding females, OR2, has dropped off the radar. Her tracking collar stopped sending signals last summer, and she has not been seen since. Overall, the number of confirmed wolves statewide has grown from 48 to 2012 to 64 last year.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a blizzard watch in effect from tomorrow night through Friday afternoon for the Missoula Bitterroot Valleys, the Potomac Sealy Lake region, the West Glacier region, and in the Flathead and Mission Valleys. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 3 to 10 degrees. Tomorrow, rain is likely with a slight chance of light freezing rain and snow. Expect highs in the 30s. In central Montana, there's a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow evening through Saturday afternoon for the Southern Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade, Shoto, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark County, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr County. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 5 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day. Expect highs 25 to 35 degrees. And in southwest Montana, there's also a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow evening through Saturday afternoon for the entire southwest Montana region. Tonight, look for increasing clouds with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be cloudy. Expect snow through the day. Rain is also likely in the afternoon, with highs in the mid-30s. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
As the 2014 political campaign kicks into high gear, politicians are beginning to feature a powerful rhetorical tool, the appeal to common sense. President Obama recently gave a 15-minute policy speech in which he invoked the phrase 5 times. Last Monday, Senate candidate Steve Daines published an op-ed in Montana newspapers in which he used the phrase 4 times in 700 words. But while the appeal to common sense seems to suggest that we all ought to agree on whatever is proposed, in the political context, it ought to spur us to a much different task. The idea of common sense has a long history with multiple meanings. Related concepts in the ancient Roman world equated it with pre-rational beliefs and sensibilities that cannot or need not be questioned. In contrast, some Enlightenment thinkers of the 17th and 18th centuries described it as something like one's rationality or practical judgment. Today, Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines common sense as, quote, sound and prudent judgment based on a simple perception of the situation or facts, end quote. Even this small sampling of definitions raises important questions. Is common sense a capacity of good judgment, or is it composed of substantive beliefs about how to live? In either case, does it exist universally in human beings? Does common sense refer to basic assumptions that are beyond rational criticism, or does it require such criticism? Whether you think of common sense as a capacity or as a set of beliefs or sensibilities, I think we should be suspicious of any claims about its universality. Even philosophers who thought of common sense as a capacity born by all recognized that not everyone could exercise it well. Thus, people may appeal to what they think is common sense, but it may be poor judgment instead. When common sense includes substantive claims about the way the world is or ought to be, there is even more reason for suspicion. Albert Einstein once called common sense, quote, the collection of prejudices acquired by age 18, end quote. If he's even close to right, those prejudices will vary greatly among cultures. What may seem like common sense to most Canadians, for example, that the government ought to ensure access to health care, is debated in our country. Appeals to common sense in the political realm have a history dating to the beginning of our nation. Thomas Paine's 1776 pamphlet, called simply Common Sense, appealed to all classes of people in America, not just to the elite, on behalf of independence for the colonies. But note that the appeal took the form of an argument, not merely an assertion. In contemporary political speech, appeals to common sense are among the most dubious, being almost dismissive of argument. Instead, they serve other purposes. They are a trademark of populism on the political right and left. Politicians invoking common sense are trying to show that they stand not with the elite, of whom we should be suspicious, but rather with the common person, who, it is assumed, possesses common sense in greater measure than politicians, with the exception, of course, of the one who is talking to them. In addition, as linguist Jeffrey Nunberg argues, politicians love appealing to common sense because it makes their solutions seem simple and obvious to anyone not clouded by political ideology. For example, Congressman Daines puts forward what he calls common sense forest management reforms, namely nationally mandated logging quotas. It sounds simple enough, but it actually runs afoul of basic wildlife and sustainable forest management principles and current land use agreements. What he terms senseless barriers to coal development may in fact be reasonable health or climate protections that sound a lot like common sense to others. Far from overcoming political ideology, common sense is rather used as its cover. At best, appeals to common sense in politics may help us get beyond entrenched political battles. More typically, though, they are condescending and reductionistic. They suggest that the answers to complex problems are simple. They are dismissive of argument and analysis. They arrogantly assume that the possessor of common sense has better judgment than any so-called expert. When the appeal to common sense is meant to convince us that policy proposals are beyond justification or don't need to acknowledge the complexity of facts or competing values, that's precisely the time that we should suspect that something other than policy solutions is on the agenda. At the very least, we need to examine the proposal more closely rather than assume that a simple perception of the solution will do. Common sense may well be part of how we need to face the more straightforward aspects of life, but beware the politician who claims to have it when the problems are anything but simple. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.
I'm Clay Scott. You're listening to Montana Public Radio. KUFL, Libby, 90.5, KUKL, Kalispell, 90.1, KPJH, Polson, 89.5, KUFM, Missoula, 89.1, KUFN, Hamilton, 91.9, KGPR, Great Falls, 89.9, KUHM, Helena, 91.7, KAPC, Butte, 91.3. You can also listen online at mtpr.org.
Sponsored in part by SBS Solar, serving Western Montana, offering solar energy solutions for homes and businesses, located at 401 South Orange in Missoula. Financing information available at sbslink.com.
Coming up next on Montana Public Radio, we have All Things Considered from NPR. Stay with us. The time is 6 p.m.
Every 2 gallons of seawater that goes in, 1 gallon of high-quality drinking water comes out, and 1 gallon of very salty seawater goes back to the ocean.
Using ocean water to help with drought troubles in California.
Today is Wednesday, February 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. Coming up, looking to desalination and beyond, harvesting rainwater and other ways to fend off drought.
Here in California, if we're lucky, we get 4 or 5 big storms a year. We have to be a little bit more creative if we want to capture all that water.
And facing budget cuts, the Environmental Protection Agency offers employee buyouts.
Also, government scientists try to settle the controversy over the plastic additive BPA.
The results both support and extend the conclusion from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that BPA is safe as currently used.
First, this hour's news.